There we go. So this is actually the third year I've done this course, and I'll tell you, I'm always excited when I come here because everyone seems so enthusiastic about gastroenterology, and I really think that GI is an excellent arena and area for people who are, you know, wanting to see patients and see patients in clinic, and it's always thought of as such a procedural subspecialty, but really, you know, you don't get to the procedures until you actually take care of patients and figure out what you need to do. And I think Dr. Metz's talk about what tests we should order was really a nice way to set this up. Now, it's always been interesting to me that I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and I come from a long line of plumbers. In fact, most of my family on one side are plumbers. And I didn't really realize this until probably 3 years ago at Christmas when my Uncle Tony, and I swear I have an Uncle Tony, actually said to me, you know, you're just a plumber. And, you know, it dawned on me that he's kind of right, because essentially what I do is I look at a pipe and I try to make that pipe work better. So that analogy kind of holds true. And when thinking about that, I always think it's amazing. When you think about what has to happen when you take a piece of food and you put it in your mouth and you swallow it, I mean, almost instantaneously, it has to be delivered through a very small upper esophageal sphincter that's being compressed by the spine and the airway. And then once it gets into the esophagus, it has to wiggle its way down and navigate around a lot of structures. Once again, the airway, the heart, the aorta, and then it has to dive into this really small hole in a diaphragm that's actually moving up and down. So the fact that we actually get food from our mouth into our stomach is a miracle, and it really is. But it's also interesting that, you know, when you think about the esophagus, if the esophagus works, it's great, things go down. But if the esophagus doesn't work at all, you could still do okay. It's really when the esophagus is not working well in terms of different types of patterns of peristalsis. And when you see that, that's really where the problems arise and people develop symptoms. So when I think about esophageal symptoms, I like to think about esophageal symptoms in two main groups. And one is the transit-related, and that's the plumbing. And I'll have to admit, that's the fun part, because that's really the one that I think we have the most dramatic opportunity to help people. So that's when you're looking at the transport from the mouth into the stomach, or trying to block the transport from the stomach into the esophagus. So you're looking at either antegrade or retrograde. So we have a lot of ways that we can help people with this, and they range from endoscopic procedures, maybe medications, and also surgery if it gets to that point. What's probably more difficult, though, are the perception-mediated symptoms. So when patients come in with heartburn, chest pain, thermal issues where they feel symptoms with cold or hot, that's very interesting because we don't have a very good handle as to why people have these symptoms. In fact, even heartburn, when you think about heartburn, a pretty generic, typical symptom, we all know, you see commercials about it, but we actually don't know what causes heartburn in how that symptom is generated. Now, if you put a balloon in the esophagus and you blow it up, a lot of the time, you're not going to feel pressure or a stabbing pain. A lot of the time, you're actually going to feel a burning. And I know that because I've actually had a balloon in my esophagus. It was distended, and I felt heartburn. So the way the esophagus integrates threats in the esophagus in terms of how the brain perceives it is very interesting. And I don't think we have a very clear understanding of how to deal with that. So those symptoms are usually much more difficult to deal with. So now when we think about the etiology of esophageal symptoms, we heard already, endoscopy is a very important tool, okay? There's no discounting that it has a very important role when you see patients with dysphagia, chest pain, heartburn, regardless, because you're looking for alternative diagnoses, and we heard this multiple times, even in the workup of GERD. The main reason I do an upper endoscopy is to look for an alternative diagnosis. And if you do see something like severe esophagitis or a stricture, those are certainly something that you can do something about right away. You can dilate those patients, you can start them on a PPI, and they do very well. Now, of course, you just heard from one of my colleagues, Iko Hirano, about eosinophilic esophagitis. That's also kind of the new kid on the block in terms of esophageal diseases, but that's a fun disease to deal with too, because there's a lot of transit-mediated problems, and you can fix that. You can do dilation therapy, you can give patients medicines, you can even manipulate their diet. Now, in terms of radiography and the barium esophagram, the time barium esophagram, the regular upper GI, that's still an important part of our workup in terms of esophagology, but it's usually now, instead of a first-line study, it's something that we get later on, and sometimes it can be very useful in equivocal cases where you're kind of confused. So that's really where the esophagram has come into play in my evaluation of dysphagia, especially when I'm thinking about things that may be a little bit equivocal, when I'm trying to rule out whether or not someone truly has achalasia versus maybe scleroderma. And that's something they're almost diametrically opposed in many ways, but sometimes very difficult to figure out. So that's where we get. So once we've done an upper endoscopy and we've ruled out that there's an obstruction, a mechanical obstruction, that's really where we start looking at these propulsive disorders. Patients usually presenting with liquid solid dysphagia. So typically obstruction, mechanicals, or solid food dysphagia, but then when they start having liquid too, then you start thinking about propulsive disorders. But remember, if someone has a big piece of meat stuck in their esophagus, they're also going to have liquid dysphagia, because as soon as that liquid hits the obstruction, it's going to come right back up. But that being said, if we see people with liquid dysphagia on top of solid, you know, we start to think that this might be a propulsive disorder, and that's where we start thinking about all of these other motility abnormalities, which we'll discuss in so much more detail as we progress here. But also, you have to realize that many times we do find patients with negative endoscopies, negative manometries, and when I say negative manometries, nothing overt or nothing really severe, and in those particular patients, they tend to have what we call functional dysphagia, functional heartburn, functional chest pain, and they can be some of our most challenging patients. But you always have to realize that there's always this kind of overlap of propulsive disorders with GERD, because gastroesophageal reflux disease is as much a motility disorder as it is an acid peptic disorder. So people get gastroesophageal reflux because they have abnormalities in their anatomy and their anti-reflux mechanisms, and of course peristaltic function, which helps clear the liquid or the gastric refluxate. Now, as you saw, and I, just for historical sake, I want to kind of take you through the old manometry, and many of you probably never see this, but I have to say, I spent most of my career working on manometry that looked like this, essentially pressure tracings. So what you saw was there was still a transnasal catheter, and there were pressure sensors spaced anywhere from 3 to 5 centimeters apart, and you had these very nice pressure tracings where you could actually see this propagation. So you'll see these peaks in this contraction here propagating down the esophagus, and if you can see the arrow mouse here, you can see that. And by looking at patterns of relaxation that are occurring at the lower esophageal sphincter and patterns of contraction, we were able to do a really good job at characterizing esophageal motor disorders. In fact, esophageal motor disorders were really not defined by pathology. We don't get a specimen of the muscle and look at it. We actually define it based on patterns, and this was really the state of the art, and it did really well. In fact, in the hands of a very good manometric interpreter, this technique is as good as these high-resolution manometry techniques. The high-resolution manometry techniques make things easier and maybe helps us differentiate some variants, but really, in the hands of a good interpreter, this was a very good technique. Well, eventually, a guy named Ray Klaus, who unfortunately is no longer with us, really came up with this concept. What he thought was, well, we were missing some information in between these sensors. So if we put more sensors spaced closer together, we would get a better picture of what was going on in the esophagus. And when he first did this, he looked at this. This really didn't help all that much. So this is high-resolution manometry. It means you have more sensors spaced closer together. So when you look at this, I don't know that that really helps me more than the pressure tracing. It really wasn't until he tried to figure out a better way to display the manometric data. And what he did was he used a fancy technique called interpolation where he averaged pressure signals and he changed pressure from a tracing to a color. So as Dr. Metz explained to you, you can actually see manometric anatomy here. You can actually see the upper sphincter. You can see the lower sphincter. You can see the striated muscle, the transition zone where it converts to smooth muscle. And by converting that information to color plots, this became more akin to an imaging technique, where you would open the study, you'd see it immediately, and you'd know what was going on. And that's how we started to look at this. We started looking at this more in terms of pattern recognition than making these distinct measurements of the peristaltic amplitude, the peristaltic velocity. So really, in honor of Ray Klaus, I think we should all be calling these Klaus plots, because if it wasn't for Ray, we really wouldn't have the Chicago classification. So the other thing that it allowed us to do was see luminal pressure. So there's a lot of things that we would see on a manometric tracing that really wasn't a contraction. It was actually the bolus being squeezed in the esophagus. And that is now easy to remedy or actually distinguished from a true contractile pressure. And we were also able to get more accurate into assessing important parameters like EGJ relaxation, peristaltic propagation, in terms of looking at something called latency, which we'll discuss in a little bit. Now, there are multiple different techniques and methodologies that are around, and there are certainly three main manufacturers of this equipment. And remember, high-resolution manometry and esophageal pressure topography have nothing to do with the manufacturer. It's basically increased sensors, decreased spacing, and the way you display the data. Now, the one caveat to that is that you have to use normative ranges that have been developed for each of these unique techniques. So if you use an IRP level of 15 for one technique, that might not be the right IRP value to use for another manufacturer's equipment because they need or they require a different normative range. So it's just important to remember some of these values you cannot use cross technology. So this is actually the Chicago classification updated. And it's funny because I was just talking to some of my colleagues here that this is actually brand new. This is the first time I've actually shown this slide in public, and this is really the updated version. And I think, although it looks very complicated, it does make things a little bit more clear, and we're going to go through this in a little bit more specifics. So if you think about it, as we heard before, the first thing that we do when we see these patients and we've diagnosed that their endoscopy is negative, or as negative as it can be, we've ruled out eosinophilic esophagitis, they don't have any major strictures or inflammation, we do a manometry as the next step in that case if they have dysphagia. We are really focused on the esophagogastric junction because we break these patients up into two groups, those that have an obstruction at the EGJ and those who do not. And when I say an obstruction at the EGJ, that may be a subtle mechanical obstruction that was missed on endoscopy, something that might only be picked up on an endoscopic ultrasound, or it may truly be achalasia. So these particular entities are broken up into two groups, achalasia, which is then subdivided into three classifications, type 1, 2, and 3. And then if there looks like there's some peristalsis there, and it doesn't have this typical achalasia pattern, they get labeled into EGJ outflow obstruction, which may be achalasia in evolution, so early achalasia, or it could be a true mechanical obstruction that was missed. So if you look at the clinical evolution of achalasia, as Dr. Metz said, I did make that comment. I wish I would have called type 2 type 1 because type 2 really is the earlier form. Now, I didn't know this when I saw this and I was looking at these patterns, but what I did notice was that the classic entity, which meant no evidence of contraction in the body and a poorly relaxing EGJ, seemed to be the classic definition, so I made that type 1. But in actuality, what you see here is that this progression of the clinical evolution of achalasia, where patients present initially with chest pain and dysphagia, then they progress to a little bit of dilatation, and when they start to dilate, they feel better because now the esophagus is starting to act like the stomach. It has capacity. It's holding the food. And then, hopefully, you treat them before they get to the next level because if they're allowed to progress, they will actually progress to severe esophageal dilatation. And to be honest, once they get to that point, their only option is esophagectomy. There's really nothing that can actually treat this. You can do whatever you want to the esophagogastric junction, but at that point, the game is over. You're going to take their esophagus out. So these are examples of the subtypes of achalasia. Type 1, classic, no evidence of peristalsis here, poorly relaxing EGJ. Here you can see some mild dilatation. Type 2, here you see this very strange pattern where there's bolus being squeezed. So picture a water balloon being squeezed at both ends. What you'll see is actually pressurization in the body. It's just like a balloon being distended. And what you'll see is this very nice pattern. And as you saw, this purple color actually looks like liquid. And if you look at this comparative esophagram here, you can actually see this air fluid level here, which correlates very nicely with this impedance signal. And in fact, in our lab now, we're actually giving people 200 cc's of normal saline at the end of the study, and it actually has replaced the time barium esophagram in us because it correlates very well. And then, of course, there's this entity, which is really a very difficult entity to treat, which is type 3 achalasia. It's a combination of distal esophageal spasm and an achalasia sphincter. It doesn't relax. So if you treat the sphincter in these patients, you're still left with spasm. So you got to think a little bit outside the box with those particular patients. Here's a couple of examples of EGJ outflow obstruction, where in one particular example, this is peristalsis, an impaired EGJ relaxation. This patient wound up having achalasia. They had very nice histologic features of ganglion loss at the lower esophageal sphincter after they had their Heller myotomy. But you could also see that they had this huge epiphrenic diverticulum here on the esophagram, and right there is a location of where that diverticulum formed on the high-resolution manometer. You'd never be able to see this in a tracing format. Here's another example of a patient had peristalsis, but in this particular patient, this patient had a very subtle stricture that was missed on endoscopy because it was about 12 and a half, 13 millimeters, and we could clearly see that the barium tablet on the esophagram got caught. But you can clearly see here that during this particular study on this woman here that there was compartmentalization of the pressure here, so you could tell that there was some obstruction here, but this was not because the sphincter was not relaxing. It was really because of a stricturing that occurred. So this is more of a mechanical obstruction. So we would not treat this patient like achalasia. We would dilate the patient, and that's what we did. We actually passed a 54 French savory, and the patient did extremely well afterwards. Now, how well does this subtype classification hold up? Well, we don't have good prospective data because we just came up with this a few years or maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and we're actually getting that data more and more. But we've seen multiple. Now there's 7 peer-reviewed studies that have looked at the subtypes, and really the prognostic implications of the subtype holds out. If you have type 2 achalasia, you're early, you're not dilated, you treat these patients, they have a very good prognosis, 90-95%, regardless of what you use, pneumatic dilation or surgery. In contrast, if you have type 3 achalasia, 29% to anywhere around 50-60%, depending on how severe it is. And I'll tell you, the people who've actually had better success with type 3 are actually miscalling type 4, which is EGJ outflow obstruction, type 3. Because when you actually look at their studies, they're calling the easy one type 3, and that's why they have better results. But if you have truly spastic achalasia, you're not going to do very well with therapy just focused at the esophagogastric junction. So high-resolution manometry has really impacted the way I take care of these patients because when I see these patients, it sets the stage for what I'm going to do. So if you have an EGJ outflow obstruction, those particular patients, I'm going to get further imaging. I have a low threshold for getting endoscopic ultrasound to make sure that I'm not going to miss a subtle obstruction. And we've picked up tumors that were missed on endoscopy, small stromal tumors, adenocarcinomas, unfortunately. Once you find it on EUS in this particular scenario, it's usually not a good situation. Those patients have a very poor prognosis. But we've also found sarcoidosis via EUS. We found eosinophilic esophagitis that was transmural with endoscopic ultrasound. So once again, if we see EGJ outflow obstruction, we really go the extra mile to rule out obstruction. And then if that's negative, we treat them like achalasia. Now, patients who have absent peristalsis, meaning they have no contractility, but their EGJ relaxation pressure may be borderline, those patients may be scleroderma, but they may be achalasia. This is really where an esophagram for me is really helpful. I'll do a time barium esophagram, and if there's significant bolus retention, then I'll treat that patient like they have achalasia, and I'll usually start in those particular patients with a pneumatic dilation, just because they're still somewhat equivocal. Now, achalasia type 1, this patient population, in my mind, pneumatic dilation is a good therapy, but I tend to veer towards getting a Heller myotomy or a POEM because those patients tend to require a very profound reduction in their LES pressure because their esophageal pressure is so low. So in order to empty, you really have to lower the lower esophageal sphincter pressure, and certainly surgery does that to a much better degree than pneumatic dilation. Type 2 achalasia, if I diagnose that, I feel great. I tell the patient you're going to do very well. It doesn't matter. You can choose whichever you want. And I usually let patient preference dictate what procedure they undergo. Type 3 achalasia, these patients, I do not offer pneumatic dilation anymore. I used to, but now I don't, because I realize that what I'm doing is I'm just converting achalasia to spasm. So I used to give patients Viagra. That worked pretty well, but it's very hard to get that covered by insurance. In fact, insurance will cover a surgery much easier than they'll actually cover Viagra for esophageal motor disorder, and hopefully you won't have to find that out. But what we've actually been doing these patients is using a technique called POEM that I'll show you in a little bit, where we can actually tailor the myotomy to cover the entire spastic component. And we've actually done 6 patients already using this tailored approach, and they've all done extremely well. So we're very optimistic that this is the way to go. And then, of course, if we diagnose someone with DES, these particular patients will treat very similar to achalasia, but more focus on the body abnormality. So what are the treatment options? And I've alluded to these. Well, I'll tell you, right now, our medications in my practice, I only use for patients who are not surgical candidates. And I'll also use it as a temporizing effect. Sometimes patients have to wait 6 to 8 weeks before they can get a myotomy. So in those particular patients, I may give them some intermediate nitrates, calcium channel blockers, and if they have decent insurance, I'll try to get them some Viagra, which once again is off-label utilization, but does work as a very good smooth muscle relaxant. So once again, I think it's something that is difficult to get through insurance. Botox, really only reserved for patients who are not surgical candidates. You know, you have to do it every 6 to 12 months, so really not a viable option for someone who's going to live 10 or 15 years. So really our therapies are relegated to pneumatic dilation and lap-Heller myotomy. And certainly there are emerging treatments that I'll talk about. So this is the New England Journal study, criticized by the surgeons because it did show that they're pretty equivalent, pneumatic dilation and Heller myotomy. But, I mean, there are some caveats that need to be brought up about this. So this is basically stating that if you're willing to accept the fact that you might need multiple pneumatic dilations, and remember, pneumatic dilation is an outpatient procedure. People stay in the GI suite for maybe 4 to 6 hours. We monitor them. Pretty good success rate, about 70 to 80% first time. But then if I do a second one and a third one, I can get people up to about 85, 90%. But patients need to be willing to have to undergo multiple treatments. And if they are willing to undergo multiple treatments, then that particular therapy is as effective as a surgical myotomy. And that's what the New England Journal study showed. Now, once again, all of these things are operator dependent. So you don't want to get a pneumatic dilation from someone who does one every 2 to 3 years, because then your perforation rate may be high. But if you go to someone who does these a lot, the perforation rates are pretty low. So although we tend to quote a perforation rate of 1 in 20 to 1 in 25 for pneumatic dilation, I'll tell you at our institution it's about 1 in 500. So I tell patients, this is the number I have to quote you, but I'll tell you that our experience is much better than that. Similarly, if someone does one Heller myotomy a year, their rates of perforation during the operation is going to be very high, and their success rate is going to be very low. And I'll tell you, when they do their door fundoplasty to prevent reflux, they're going to have a lot of complications. So you want to go to somebody who's a high-volume practitioner when you get any one of these. And I think if you do it the right way and you go to people who are experienced, you're going to have pretty good success rates, anywhere up to 80 to 90%. So this is the new kid on the block, peroral endoscopic myotomy. So this is kind of a hybrid. We can actually do endoscopy now, and this is done by gastroenterologists and surgeons. You make a longitudinal incision right here in the submucosa, and you actually burrow a hole. You can dissect, you can put a balloon in there, any technique. And then once you make this submucosal tunnel, and this really came out of all of the endoscopic dissection techniques that they use for Barrett's and early invasive or non-invasive cancers. And once you get down to this level, and you see this nice tunnel here in the submucosa, you can use this triangular cautery device and just cut the circular muscle. So it's like doing a precision endoscopic myotomy, kind of akin to a Heller myotomy, but done endoscopically. And I'll tell you, we don't have great data to say which one's the best, but our initial, we've done about 100 now, actually a little more than 100, and our success rates are around 90%. Now, that being said, we don't know the durability, so it may be that we might need to do another POEM, or they may need something else in the future. But overwhelmingly, when I give these three options to my patients, they almost always have been choosing POEM. That's why we've done 100 in the last 2 years. So when people are given this opportunity of less invasive procedure, endoscopic, one day overnight stay, pretty good success rates, they're willing to take that gamble. And right now, there is a randomized international POEMA study that is comparing pneumatic dilation to POEM. And I think those results will be very interesting. But I think the most important thing that we're going to have to really decide about here, or actually discover, is what's the durability of this technique. So we like it, it works, short-term results are great. There's a lot of ambiguity in terms of what's the best test 10 or 15 years ago. Because remember, we don't cure achalasia. We fix the plumbing. We let it empty and drain better. So in summary, I think we've been able to accurately define achalasia much better, and this has allowed us to tailor our therapy better. The patterns do have potential therapeutic impact, although we don't have the good prospective data to show that, but I'm pretty confident that our studies at least are going to show that. And then in the end, you know, we do have these new technologies that are allowing us to do this. Well, what about the other disorders? Well, I spent most of my talk talking about achalasia, and the reason for that is it's the most well-defined esophageal motor disorder, and to be honest, it's the one that we have the most effective therapy for. So now, as we go progressively down the Chicago classification, our therapies are less and less effective. So it's just kind of important to know that. So we love achalasia in terms of esophageal motor disorders because it's fun. We can treat people, we make them better. But what about these other major disorders of peristalsis? Well, these entities are entities that you never see in asymptomatic controls. So I've looked at 1,500 asymptomatic controls, and I've never seen anyone have something like a jackhammer pattern or a true spastic pattern in a control patient. But what I have seen is a lot of ineffective esophageal motility, a lot of rapid contractions, a lot of fragmented contractions. So in this particular group, these are patients who have abnormalities that are never seen in control. So these are probably primary motor abnormalities. And these are really distal esophageal spasm, defined using refined measurements, jackhammer esophagus, which is really a spastic severe nutcracker, and then absent contractility, which we used to call scleroderma esophagus, but we don't call it that anymore because it has negative connotations. You tell someone who's just reflux that they have scleroderma esophagus, they go online, they think they're going to die. So we tried to get rid of that terminology, so we call it absent contractility. I think as this thing evolves, the Chicago classification evolves, we're trying to make it simple and clear so that it makes sense. The terminology, a lot of angst goes into picking out each word in each one of these definitions. I don't know how I got jackhammer through. I still don't understand how that got through, but it got through because everyone hated spastic nutcracker. They thought it was a confusing group that we initially called, and they were looking for something else, so they were much more amenable to jackhammer esophagus than truly spastic nutcracker. And this is what jackhammer esophagus looks like. So what you see here is a beautiful contraction propagating very well, and these repetitive kind of jackhammer-like contractions. And really, in hindsight, that terminology of spastic nutcracker was actually very, in my mind, hindsight's 20/20. But what we're finding now is when these patients come in and we're doing ambulatory manometry and we're actually giving patients prescriptions for stat manometry when they have chest pain, when they come in and they have this pattern, what they have is this spastic contraction. And their chest pain almost always uniformly lines up with these spasm-like contractions. And it looks like an accordion. I jokingly call it the Ravi middle esophagus because he always talked about the longitudinal muscle contraction. And that's what it looks like. It's this squeezing of the esophagus. And we have a couple of case reports that are actually going to be published very soon that show this particular pattern. So this jackhammer pattern, patients typically don't have pain when you do the manometry and you see this. But what it tells you is that something bad is going on. And these patients almost uniformly have chest pain and severe dysphagia. So how do we treat this? Well, we treat this by using smooth muscle relaxants, and we've actually tried Botox. And I'll tell you, I was really optimistic about Botox. We were doing endoscopic ultrasound and Botoxing the entire esophagus. Well, two things happened. One was there were two reported deaths using that technique for mediastinitis, so we stopped doing it. But also, the efficacy wasn't that good. And we weren't going to relegate these people to every 6 to 12 months Botox for jackhammer esophagus. So what we've done is we've created kind of a smooth muscle algorithm. So what we do is we start out with Isodil. So 5 milligrams PO TID for 3 days. If people don't get better, we escalate it to 10 milligrams PO TID for 3 days. You should really see an effect in these patients pretty quickly. If you don't see anything at that point, what we do is we add on an anticholinergic. So, for instance, Levsin at 0.125 micrograms, and then milligrams. Sorry. And then what we'll do is we'll actually go through and we'll increase that to maybe 0.25 TID over 3 days. So everything's 3 days because you should see an effect. Now, if they fail that regimen, the combination of Levsin and Isodil, then what we'll do is we'll use that as evidence or at least information to move on to Sildenafil or Viagra. And that will allow us to tell the insurance company that the patient failed two different smooth muscle relaxants. And I'll tell you that in this particular entity, Viagra works very well. It can actually cause those contractions to almost completely normalize. But once again, am I going to leave a 24-year-old female on Viagra for the rest of their life? Probably not. So what we've actually been doing more and more now is sending patients for POEM. And what we're doing is we're converting the jackhammer esophagus to almost a scleroderma absent contractile esophagus. Now, I don't know if long-term that's the smartest thing to do. But if someone's definitely not responding to the Viagra, it's our only option for these patients because this can be debilitating. But I don't know, what would I rather do? Long-term Viagra or get a POM and get converted to scleroderma esophagus? It's a toss-up, I don't know. But I'll tell you, most patients are actually going for POM. And we're, once again, studying this over a 5 to 10 year period. Now, what about spasm? Well, we've completely redefined how we look at spasm because what we found out was, and I'm no different, I misdiagnosed spasm probably half or 75% of the time up until a few years ago because I relied solely on peristaltic velocity. And what happened was I forgot to realize that these two really smart guys, Behar and Biancani, many years ago had said that the thing that distinguishes spasm is not peristaltic velocity, it's something called latency. So it doesn't matter how fast the contraction is, it matters how quickly it intersects the EGJ. So a premature contraction is really what gives spasm. And this is what latency means here. So what you see here is in the striated muscle contraction, it's pretty normal. But as soon as you hit the smooth muscle esophagus, there's almost a simultaneous contraction, and it intersects the EGJ within 3 to 5 seconds. So the esophagus needs 4.5 seconds to empty. If the contraction hits the EGJ before 4.5 seconds, the bolus is going to sit in the esophagus and get squeezed, almost like a water balloon being twisted. And that's what you see right here, a twisted corkscrew esophagus. Now, what happens is if you look at patients who actually have very high velocities but normal latency intervals, so they don't have a premature contraction, that's actually just weak contractions or even a normal variant. So it's no wonder that all these studies that showed that smooth muscle relaxants didn't work for spasm, didn't work. Well, we were just making weak contractions weaker or normal contractions weak. Many of the patients we were treating were not actually spasm. So that really, that's what high-resolution manometry allowed us to appreciate. It didn't invent spasm. It allowed us to appreciate what true spasm was and to reinvigorate the work by Behar and Biancani. So what do? Same thing for jackhammer. Same smooth muscle protocol. And then if those patients don't respond to that, we're offering POM to these particular patients. And I'll tell you, these patients can be very refractory to treatment. And that's why we're willing to go that extra length, and no pun intended, because it's extra length of myotomy with POM. So it's a very effective therapy for those particular patients. And we've probably done about 5 or 6 of those already who've got to that point. And they're also doing very well. In fact, our type 3 achalasia, we do a tailored POM where we cut the entire smooth muscle esophagus. Well, what about the other minor disorders, like ineffective esophageal motility, fragmented peristalsis? Well, let's look at those. So here's the progression. This is absent contractility. So if you had 10 of these, you would basically have absent contractility. Remember, old scleroderma esophagus, very difficult to treat. Your only real options here are lifestyle modifications and treat their reflux aggressively. Make sure they sleep with the head of the bed elevated, soft foods, convert big tablets, big capsules to smaller ones or liquid formulations. Very important. But then we have this progression of weak peristalsis, where in this particular case, this is absent contractility. Maybe there's a small foci here. This is a weak peristaltic contraction. The DCI, which is a measurement of peristaltic contractility now, it's very objective. If it's below 450, it's a weak contraction. Well, what happens if the contraction has this big fragment here? Well, it may be strong, but it has this defect. So in the new version, we now call this fragmented peristalsis as opposed to weak because the contraction is still strong, it just has this big gap. Well, why is this important? Well, here you see a very nice example of a person who was told they were crazy. This person was told over and over that this was all in their head. They had normal manometries, normal endoscopies, but they kept saying things are getting caught here. Well, she happened to come in, get a high-resolution manometry. This is actually early in my career when I had no idea what I was doing. But when I did the high-resolution manometry, I looked at the pattern, I said, there's something wrong here. There's a big hole. And she was pointing right to there when she actually had her symptoms. And when I looked at her old manometries, which one was done at our institution that we called normal, they were normal. This is what it looked like. Beautiful contractions, 3 and 8 centimeters above the EGJ. But it was funny because she called me a week later and told me there was a pill stuck. I went in there, popped it off, and there I saw a Neurontin tattoo where her Neurontin was stuck and it was right in that transition zone area. So what did it allow me to do? Well, I didn't really do much in terms of her therapy. I didn't change exactly what I did in terms of give her a new medicine. I told her she wasn't crazy. I told her to eat soft foods, and I converted her Neurontin to smaller formulation, and she got better. So this allowed me to treat the patient's symptoms, not necessarily give her a medicine or surgery, but make her feel better. So that really goes into my last two slides. When you see these patients and they have these minor motor abnormalities or normal manometry, and they've gone through this, we label these patients with functional chest pain, functional dysphagia, functional heartburn. What do you do with those patients? We see these patients a lot, and I'll tell you, these are the patients that are going to be punted right back to our nurse practitioners and our physician assistants because they're hard. Doctors don't like dealing with them because they are hard. But I'll tell you, what we tend to do at Northwestern is we really focus on talking the patient down. And really, if you look at it, what are the options here? These patients are offered low-dose antidepressants, which are off-label. Efficacy is really questionable. Don't really work, to be honest, in most patients. You might have 10 or 15% yield in those, but we use them a lot. We might use some SSRIs. It depends. And I think most people just use whatever they're comfortable with. I don't think that's a problem. For me, I love using amitriptyline and citalopram. Those are the two that I tend to use most. If someone has more of a hypertensive pattern, even though it's normal, I might give them a low-dose TCA because of the anticholinergic effect. That's all just me trying to theorize why it works. I have no data to support that. And then if they have weakness, then I'll give them an SSRI because that doesn't have any anticholinergic effect. Once again, no reason why I tailor it. It's just that I feel comfortable doing that. But what I'm actually more interested in is sending people for gut-directed hypnotherapy and cognitive behavioral therapy. Because what we do here is we convince the patient that they're not going to die, that this is not going to affect their quantity of life, it's going to affect their quality of life. And what we need to do is to just make them forget about it and not care about it. So cognitive behavioral therapy basically works on talking them down, making them forget about it. They don't concentrate on it. They don't think they have cancer over and over because we've shown them that they don't have it. And then if we have to, we use hypnotherapy, which essentially turns the brain off. So how do I sell hypnotherapy to someone who's having trouble swallowing? I always look at my watch, and if they're wearing a watch, I say, can you feel your watch? And they always look at me like I'm crazy. And they say, well, yeah. And I'm like, well, did you feel it a few minutes ago? And they're like, well, no. And I'm like, well, think about what your brain does on a daily basis. It shuts all of those sensations off so you can go ahead, you can do what you need to do in your daily life. If you felt your clothes, if you felt the tie around your neck, if you felt your glasses, you'd go insane. That wouldn't go away. Well, what hypnotherapy does with metaphors directed and relaxation techniques, it just does the same thing. It allows the brain to filter those signals out. So when they swallow, they may feel a little bit of something there, but it kind of goes down and they just don't care. And I'll tell you, it's very effective. For Globus, we published a small series of 10 patients, Globus, a lump in the throat. 9 out of 10 patients got better. I'll tell you, before we started doing this, I didn't fix any Globus. I put people on PPIs and I hope they didn't come back. But now when they come, I treat them and they get better and they come back and they're happy. And they understand the disease process, so very, very important. So the key clinical take-home points here are esophageal symptoms can have a number of overlapping etiologies. Remember, GERD, achalasia, EOE, it's hard to tell just from clinical, you know, when you're talking to patients. There's a lot of overlap between those entities, and you really have to do some investigations, and I think David's talk about how to go through that was very important. Most of these disorders can be managed with a careful evaluation, but you really need to treat symptoms in parallel. And I think using things like cognitive behavioral therapy and hypnosis have really changed the way I practice in terms of esophagology. So once again, don't be afraid to introduce that concept to your patients once you get to that point, and also refer them to a psychologist. And you're not telling them they're crazy. You're telling them you believe their symptoms, but you're going to make them better. So with that, I'll end. Thank you very much. In the back.
Can you speak
briefly
of the role of peppermint oil?
Yeah, so peppermint oil has been touted as a treatment for spasm. And it might. There might be some smooth muscle relaxing properties with that. But what I tell patients is that you can't treat achalasia with peppermint oil. What you can treat is maybe a hypertensive peristalsis. So if someone has, you know, borderline motor abnormalities, they may have a little bit of hypercontractility. Peppermint oil is fine. It's not going to hurt people, but you got to be careful because there was a report of someone who got referred for peppermint oil. They went to one of these whole food places and they bought candle oil and they poisoned themselves with a peppermint oil for a candle. So you have to be very careful when you refer people for stuff like that. So, you know, think alternative approaches can be benign. But, you know, if people start shopping in the wrong place, it can kill you. So just be very careful with that. So that's how I would use it. There's no good randomized controlled trials to support. You know, there's a couple of anecdotal series that tell that it works, but it's certainly not going to change a corkscrew esophagus to an uncorkscrew esophagus. All right, well, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.